everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm so happy to be here with you on this beautiful spring day. Lots of news to share with you, things going on around the city and New York, and I have a great guest on my show for you today, Lauren Groveman from Strengthening Lives Through Cooking and Baking. She's an incredible chef and culinary professional, award-winning author, and I'm going to tell you more about her in just a little bit. But first, I want to just talk to you about this week. On Tuesday, I took one of Food and Water Watch's buses up to Albany and participated in lobbying my state assemblyman, Ed Raw, and actually got to meet with him, and it was really quite amazing. I mean, there was a great rally up in Albany. We had hundreds of people there demonstrating and calling out for the passage of two bills in the state legislature, one in the Senate and one in the Assembly, both requiring mandatory labeling for GMOs. And I've gone to Albany a few times before to lobby my assemblymen and senators, but this is the first time I actually got to meet with my assemblyman and not just a staffer. And it was great. We actually got to sit down and talk with him and present our case as to why GMO foods need to be labeled, if not outright banned. But right now we're really focusing on labeling. And he heard me, and I followed up with a letter, and I actually got a letter back saying we can count on his support. And as a Republican legislator, I just felt really great, like, wow, this is cool. This is democracy in action. And I encourage more and more people to really, you know, step up to the plate, take that time. If you can't go in person, make those phone calls to your senators and assemblymen and let them know that you want the passage of this mandatory labeling. And while we were on the bus, a wonderful thing happened. We got the news that the U.S. District Court in Vermont actually denied the Manufacturers Grocery Association and Monsanto's lawsuit and sided with Vermonters in them having a right to mandatory labeling. And so Vermont is actually the first state in our country that actually has mandatory labeling and is not contingent on another state, a neighboring state, passing the same bill. One of the reasons our bills are so important is because states like Rhode Island and Connecticut have made it so that their bill or their law that was voted in only gets passed if five neighboring states do the same. And so looking at this New England region, we are a part of it, and we need to pass this bill. And then once our bill gets passed, many of these other states will come right on board. And it's so important. The right to know is a basic right. I mean, it's ridiculous. We have labels for, you know, how many calories are in a food, how many trans fats are in a food, a whole nutritional labeling. There's no reason why we cannot have labeling of GMOs. No reason at all. And, you know, you'll hear people saying, oh, well, it's going to cost the average American family $500 more a year because they're going to have to change the labels. And that's just a crock. They change labels all the time for all different reasons. Just a new marketing trend, a new picture, a new, you know, they do it all the time. And so it's not out of the ordinary. It's not going to cost anybody any more money. It's just going to cost the companies who are going to have to start labeling, it's going to cost them in reorganizing their product, because we know what's going to happen, which is what's happened in other countries, is that rather than labeling their products, food manufacturers are going to choose to make their products GMO-free, which is really great. You know, however, the problem is that there's not going to be enough raw product that's free of GMOs, and so we need to allow farmers time to transition their corn and their soybeans and their canola to GMO-free products so that they can meet the demand that is going to be coming. And they need to see the writing on the wall. The demand is coming. And anyway, so it was a great day in Albany. It was beautiful. Jerry from Ben & Jerry's was there giving all of the lobbying people some free, delicious Ben & Jerry's ice cream. They've taken the stand, you know, a long time ago. Their milk has been hormone-free and antibiotic-free for as long as I can remember, maybe always. And they're just a really great, conscientious company. And so it was really nice to have him there as well. So please sign on to the bill, write letters, call your senators and assemblymen, and let them know that you want this bill in the New York State Senate to pass. So that was great. Also, what else do I want to talk to you all about? Oh, the Rodale Institute came out with their report after a 30-year side-by-side comparison study between conventional agriculture, GMO products, and, you know, pesticide, herbicide use, and organic. And it was a 30-year study side-by-side. And after observing this farming systems trial for the past 30 years, they published the results. And as you might expect, the industrial agriculture did not outperform at all. We were promised by allowing the biotech companies to manipulate our seeds that we were going to have higher yields, better quality, less use of pesticides, and all that has been untrue. We've had to use more pesticides. We've degraded the soil. We are not getting more performance out of the crops. And so, you know, it's ruined the water quality. There's been so many downsides to it, and the organic has just outperformed on all levels. So that was a really great study. Another study that was in the news this week was that for teenagers, we really need to make sure they're getting enough potassium. Potassium you'll get in potatoes and bananas, raisins. Lots of foods are very high in potassium. Of course, you can Google and find out which foods. But that the low-salt diet that has been touted for so many years did not do anything in reducing heart disease and cholesterol as people got older, and yet potassium actually does. So that was a really interesting study that I just wanted to share with all of you. And also this week in the news, you know, they're looking at all the earthquakes that are going on in central and eastern U.S., especially Oklahoma has had more earthquakes than anywhere, and they're all man-made. They're all made from the fracking industry, and you know, it just amazed me years ago when I first heard about fracking and I was hearing about millions of gallons of liquid, water, and chemicals being pushed down into the bedrock in tremendous force. My first reaction was, isn't that going to cause earthquakes? And everybody was, no. Well, here it is. They are causing earthquakes. And it just makes sense that they would. I don't know why anyone would think you could push that much liquid down into bedrock and not cause an earthquake. Anyway, just seemed like, you know, an obvious result, and it's amazing to me that people are surprised by it. Also, I want to encourage all of you, you know, when I talk about taking action and, you know, calling your senators and congressmen, another really important issue that needs all of our support is banning neonicotinoids. Right now, the EPA has finally come out to say they will not approve any new uses of the neonicotinoids. However, neonicotinoids have been banned in many, many European countries and all around the world because they have been proven to be killing off our bees and one of the reasons for the bee claps. And yet the EPA has not done enough in this country. They're finally banning any new expansion. However, that's not doing anything for the current use of these neonicotinoids that are being used all over the place. And so we really need to let the EPA know that we want them to put a ban right now on this horrible pesticide and to stop using it. Bees are responsible for pollinating so much of our food supply, and without them, we will see more and more foods going out the window. So we need to all do our part to try to prevent that. Also, I just want to encourage all of you to make some sort of donation towards the devastation that's going on in Nepal and help in any way that you can. There's many, many different people collecting money. Please do your research and make sure that who you donate to is an organization that uses the money going right to the people hardest hit. On my website, I have a link to Global Giving, which I have found is a really good organization that does the right thing. So, you know, I encourage you all to do that. And then there's also the need for us all to support sustainable seafood for our future. And right now, the House Natural Resource Committee has a proposed legislation that they are needing support for. You can find all that information on my website at ieatgreen.com. And I urge all of you to take part in that and send letters off to your senators and congressmen. We really need the support to keep our seafood as sustainable as possible. You know, one thing that I will always say is that all of us need to try to eat more plant-based foods and reduce the amount of animal products that we're taking in, because that is not sustainable. Whether it's fish or, you know, cows or chickens or whatever the animal is, with the expanding population, it just will not, we just do not have enough if we're going to all eat at the rate that we do. So more and more people going towards plant-based diet is the sustainable way to go. And just to reduce, if you can't eliminate it totally, just reduce it and think of meat more as a seasoning than a main course or main entree. Lots of things going on in the New York City area that I want to share with you. Tonight, the Bed-Stuy Campaign Against Hunger is having a panel discussion. It's free, and it's in Brooklyn in Bed-Stuy tonight at 6 p.m., and it's called Solutions to Alleviate Poverty for an Equitable New York City. And the location is on my website. You can find more out about that. May 4th, out at our local art cinema, the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, there's a screening of Plant Pure Nation, and that is, was produced by Dr. Colin Campbell and his son. They did the Forks Over Knives film that was just great. And Dr. Colin Campbell and his son will be there in person to answer questions following the film. So that should be great. That's Monday, May 4th at 7:30 at the Cinema Arts Center. May 5th is an award dinner for Patty and Doug Wood. Patty and Doug Wood started the Grassroots Environmental Education Center out here in Port Washington. And they've been working for 30 years on raising awareness about chemical exposure, hydraulic fracking. Right now they're really raising awareness about wireless radiation and smart meters. But they've been instrumental in the Port Washington area and the whole New York region in keeping fracking waste from de-icing our streets. They are responsible for getting school gardens in most of the schools in Port Washington. They're just great, have been working on these issues for so long, and there's a free awards dinner or free awards ceremony for them at the Port Washington Library on May 5th at 7:30. Also on May 5th, Food and Water Watch is sponsoring a screening of a film called GMO-OMG. I have not seen it yet. I'm hoping to go to that. It's supposed to be a great, great film on genetically modified organisms. And I hope to see some of you there. That's in Merrick on Clubhouse Road, and that is a free screening. May 7th, the New York State Anti-Hunger Conference is taking place up in Albany. That's an all-day event from 8 to 5. You can register for that. If you go to, just Google New York State Anti-Hunger Conference, and you'll be able to get tickets there. The Long Island Food Coalition, which was the organization behind the Long Island Food Conference, which happened on Saturday. Oh, I have to talk to you all about that. I haven't talked to you about it yet. It was great. Great, great conference. Anyway, the Long Island Food Coalition, one of their partnering organizations, the Long Island Community Agricultural Network, is sponsoring some free vegetable gardening skills workshops at different libraries. And on May 7th, there's one in Shirley. On May 9th, there's one in Central Islip. The schedule is up on my website if you want to check that out. The conference that happened this past Saturday at Hofstra University was great. The turnout could have been better, but nevertheless, the people that were there all had a great time. We had over 30 different panel discussions and workshops. There were kids' workshops going on simultaneously doing, you know, making butter and beekeeping and planting some organic vegetables. It was a great, a really great conference. So hopefully next year we will do it again, and we'll get the word out there a little bit better. But it was wonderful, and everybody that participated did a great job, and all the attendees were really, really happy with it. Going back to things going on, May 9th, Riverkeeper is having a huge 2015 sweep cleaning up the Hudson River. There's over 90 cleanup sites, and you can go to their website, riverkeeper.com, and find out more about where you can join in and help clean up our local Hudson River. May 16th is a spring planting day at Catskey Farms. Catskey Farms is connected to the Sylvia Center in New York, and it's a organic garden upstate where Great Performances gets all their vegetables, and they do workshops for kids all the time. And that's a great day, and they could use your help. It's free. It's a beautiful farm, so check it out if you want to take a ride upstate. And now I want to share with you a quick recipe before I invite my guest, Lauren Groveman, on. My recipe this week is a vegan Reuben. This recipe makes two sandwiches. And so you use 1 8-ounce block of organic tempeh. And there's many varieties of tempeh out there. You can get ones with quinoa in it. You can get ones with brown rice in it. Pick whichever tempeh you would like. You need some olive oil or safflower oil, some tamari, a cup of organic sauerkraut drained, a half a cup of daikon kimchi, some vegan mayo, organic German mustard, or honeycup mustard if you want a little sweeter option, and then 4 slices of your favorite bread. And you're going to first start by slicing the block of tempeh into quarters, and then you divide each quarter in half horizontally so that you're making the slices thinner. And you're going to sauté each of those pieces in some oil until golden brown. Turn them over and repeat on the other side. And when both sides are golden brown, you're going to splash some tamari on in the hot pan and allow it to sizzle and coat the tempeh completely. Then you can remove that from the pan, and you can lay it out in some paper towel to absorb some of the some of the oil. Wipe out the pan because you're going to use it again. You're going to chop the daikon kimchi into smaller pieces and combine it with the sauerkraut and heat that in the same pan just until it's warm. You're going to toast the bread and then spread each slice of bread with some vegan mayo and some mustard. Divide the tempeh between the two sandwiches. Top it with the sauerkraut mixture. And that's it. And enjoy. It's such a delicious, delicious sandwich. It's really great, and it really satisfies any craving you might have of that old-fashioned Reuben. So enjoy it, and now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Lauren Groveman. Lauren is a certified culinary professional. She is a teacher, a cookbook author, a columnist, a recipe developer, a James Beard Award-winning radio and television host, and above all, she is a devoted wife and mother of three. And her philosophy, similar to mine, is, you know, sharing her passion and her love for cooking and trying to share her passion with others as to why it's so important for people to start cooking meals at home and restoring the family dinner. And I'm going to let her tell you more about all the work that she's doing. Lauren, are you with me?
I'm here. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. So can you share with us just a little bit about your history? How did it all begin for you as a cook, a chef? Did you go to culinary school? Are you self-taught? That kind of stuff.
Well, I I started at the beginning when I was found myself 17. I actually moved out of my parents' home at 17, moved in with my then boyfriend in Arizona who was in college, and I didn't know how to cook anything, and we needed to eat. And I've been with the same man for since then. So, I mean, we just had our 38th wedding anniversary. And
congratulations.
Thank you. I'm still crazy about him, which is wonderful. Although he didn't snore when I married him, and he snores now, but I still love him a lot. But it, in other words, it started. I did not come from when people see what I do, and they see the comfort that I have in the kitchen. They assume that I came from this in my life, and the reason why I'm telling you this is because I didn't, and that actually is what makes me, I think, a more effective communicator, as somebody can help somebody else move forward in the process, because I didn't come from it. That's what makes me special, because if I did what I did and I had a mother who did what I did, it would make perfect sense. But I didn't. But I wanted to have something better than I had. So I just had to do it myself. And from the very beginning, I mean, I've always been very nurturing. So I, you know, like when my then boyfriend, who became my husband, when I was dating him, I dated him at 15. I mean, I would make him a sandwich and I would just stare at him eating it. Just stare at him like a tuna fish sandwich. And he would like look at me like, I mean, I would really stare at him. And because I loved the feeling that I got from helping him go from being hungry to being satisfied from something that I did. Mm-hmm. And I think cooking is such an intimate sport, because you don't just look at it like you look at a painting. You actually, this is something that goes inside of another human and takes them from one place to another. And it's just something that I'm never over it. So it started way back then. And actually, the way it really began was once I got married. I used to be an actress by trade. That was my, I did some modeling and I was an actress, and I did that like when I was a teenager, and I studied to be an actress at the Lee Strasberg Institute from like the time I was 11.
Right.
And that's what I really wanted to do, other than the only other thing I wanted to do was be a mother. Once I got married at 19, I realized that being an actress, all the parts I was up for was in California. I was in New York. That's where I'm from, and that's where my husband is from. I decided that it was too conflicting for me to keep competing with people in L.A. So I decided to leave the business, which was very scary for me, because it was the only thing I ever knew I wanted to do in life other than be a mother. So once we got married, we couldn't afford to have a baby right away. I was just trying to figure out other things to do. Meanwhile, I took a couple of cooking classes, which made me dabble in it, and I felt madly in love. I would just like fall asleep at night with cookbooks all over my bed. I was like sitting up. I was just practicing and just having such a good time with that whole creative process. And we tried to have a baby, and it wasn't easy for me. And so I actually fell really in love with cooking when I wanted desperately to be a nurturer, but couldn't have a baby right away. So I fell in love with the nurturing aspect of how I was able to nurture my husband. I was able to nurture my friends. I was able to do something creatively fantastic that I could just build every day and then tear down and then share it with people and then do it again the next day. So I got very, so in other words, that's how I fell in love with cooking, from wanting to take care of a baby, but I couldn't. So I used cooking as a way to take care of myself and other people. And I got so good at it that people started to ask me to teach them what I knew once I started having children. The kids came. I have all three kids 2 years apart. So I'm so grateful for every single step of the way that I've had this process, because I'm never over it. The bread making, the everything. I'm sorry, Bonnie. I'm talking up a storm here. Stop me and ask me something. So
no,
sorry.
No. What? I'm loving it. I'm sitting here listening and I'm smiling, because it's so much. I mean, what you're describing is so much how I have felt in my own life. You know, I also am not culinary trained. I am self-taught, and I did not come from that either. My mother, you know, when I decided I was not going to be eating meat anymore, she said, fine, you're on your own. Where I had other friends who decided to become vegetarians, and their mothers, like, got, you know, went out and got cookbooks, and they were, like, you know, so worried that their kid wasn't going to get enough protein, and they started cooking beans and rice cakes for their kids. And mm-hmm. my mother's like, ah, you're on your own. I'm over it, you know? And so I was like, oh, my God. And I remember when I got my first wok, and many of my listeners probably heard this story before, I got a wok, and I opened a can of Veg-All. Do you know what Veg-All is? You know?
No, I don't.
It's what we had in my house. It's mixed vegetables with little square carrots and peas and lima beans and corn. It was disgusting.
Okay.
And I opened that can, drained it, and I put it into my wok for my first time cooking in a wok. That's, I did not know from fresh vegetables at all.
Got
so it's
it.
Really,
Well, we're probably from the same era when it was really, you know, canned vegetables and frozen dinners. And you know, my mother was the actual, she was the first Virginia Slims model. So not only did my mother not cook, but she didn't eat very much. She was one of the top models in New York, runway models. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, mothers, women were burning their bras and, you know, they were not into cooking. And, you know, when I grew up, I remember being very, very, you know, I'm self-taught, but I'm a certified culinary professional. I took a 40-page exam, not including essays. So I really did the work to know my stuff. But I remember when I was a little girl, I actually remember the very defining day when I knew that cooking was something that was very big. It was potent, is the word, potent. And I remember coming home from school, and my mother wasn't home. She was working, and I was alone. The housekeeper, we had a housekeeper who was in the kitchen, and I remember sitting on the steps in my house, and I remember smelling my housekeeper. Her name was Mabel. She was making meatballs and sauce. And I remember sitting on the step in my house saying to myself, just breathing in the smell of food cooking. And I remember feeling glad I was home to smell that. And I remember saying to myself very clearly, this smell is important because it makes me feel a certain way. I was 7. I said, I want to be the one to provide that smell, that feeling to my children someday. It felt because I was sad that my mother wasn't home. And I knew that for me to be happy, for me to heal and to create the life that I wanted, despite the fact that I didn't have it, which is so important, I knew then, that day, that cooking was always going to be something that I wanted to do for my children. And what's important about that is because I've taught people in many, many, many places, many dark places. I have a company called Hands on Food, mm-hmm. which is a not-for-profit company, where I actually built a teaching kitchen for the female inmates on Rikers Island. And I built it through donation, and I partnered with the Board of Education. At the time, this was done probably 18 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I taught there every month. I made a deal with them. I said, I will build a kitchen through donation if you will hire a full-time chef instructor to teach here every day. And I will come in every month. I will guest teach, and I will supply the program with supplies, with everything you need to run the program, but you just have to pay a chef instructor to come here every day. And they did, and I did, and I taught there every month for 11 years. And what was so important about that was that I was privy to young women who I'm sorry, that's my dog, because the trash collectors are coming. So sorry, you'll just have to hear. That's Mango, my yellow lab.
Okay.
Sorry about that. But anyway, so when I would go to jail to teach these young women, there was not one class that I had that wasn't one of these girls did not say to me, I wish you had been my mother.
Things would have been different for me had you been my mother. And the thing I said to them, and the thing I will say to any of your listeners who are saying to themselves, I wish I had a mother like that. Maybe my life would have been different. Maybe my life could have been different now. The truth is that I would say to these girls, we cannot pick our mothers. We cannot pick our fathers. But what we can try to do is to become the kind of parent that we always wished we had. That's our power. That's our job, quite honestly. You know, we're all dealt a different deck. And some of it really stinks. But the truth is, we're all here to heal. And we have to do the job to do it. And cooking is a self-healing process, and it is also a process that helps others to heal. And it's not just the eating, truly. That is the last stop on the train. It is actually ingesting aroma. Just the sounds that go on in a kitchen, the sounds of clanging and banging and searing and sauteing and the refrigerator opening and closing and drawers, those sounds are sounds of safety to a child.
Mm-hmm.
Those sounds are things that make a child actually build the anticipation for flavor, for an experience that they can carry with them into their own adult life. It is very, very important. That's one of the reasons why you can buy a roast chicken in a bag in a store. And that's not saying that you're bad if you do. It's not about good, bad, better, and best people here. But what you can't get when you buy a roast chicken is the sensory fulfillment that you get when you roast it in the house. So people actually come to the table much more physically hungry when you haven't roasted it. They need everything. When you live in a home with the aromas of baking and cooking and all of those things, you don't come to the table feeling it's now or never. I've got to fill up because this is transient. It's temporary. I don't know where my next meal is coming from. When you live a life of cooking, a homemade existence more often, you fill up. There's less. My children aren't overweight. I'm wearing the same jeans I wore a long time ago, and I don't have the superhuman metabolism. I'm a handmade girl. I make my pasta. I make my bread. I chop my vegetables. I shop for my vegetables. I have a new addition to my home. We got 3 hens last week, and trust me, I'm living like a farmer now. I'm up early, and it's just when you have this kind of life on whatever level you can maintain with a full heart. You know, if it's once a week where you have a family dinner, where you gather people around the table, your family will find comfort in knowing Friday is coming, Sunday is coming. It's not
right.
About doing it like me or doing it like anybody. It's about doing it in a way where you can love doing it. And then trust me, the better the food tastes and smells, just let your family get used to that one day. They're going to start mm-hmm. to clamor around you and want to increase it. And because, you know, this is very hard for people who've never actually done this, to incorporate it into a family all of a sudden. It's very hard to get your children at 16 to value this if they weren't encouraged to value it at 6. So you have to do it slowly. And, you know, and it's hard for the parent, too. You don't want to do it and hate it. You want to do it and love it. So it's like, just like take baby steps. Just like if you went on a tennis court for the first time or the gym for the first time, you wouldn't do 150 push-ups. You'd drop dead. You'd have to go out in a body bag. So
right.
You want to, you know what I'm saying? So like baby steps, just little things, saute an onion. So make a cookie batter and put it in the freezer in logs so that when you have the time, you just take it out of the freezer, you put it in the refrigerator overnight, you leave it in your refrigerator, and you bake a couple of cookies at whim so that you get little injections of that aroma. You know, do those things on times when you have the time to take care of yourself, when you're tired, when your kids are tired, and you want it to be nurtured. You want to be nurturing, but you're tired, and you want somebody
right.
to take care
right.
of you.
Absolutely. I want to talk about some more of those tips, like you just said, about freezing the cookie batter, because I share that with people all the time, too, little tips to make this job a little bit easier. But before we do that, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, maybe you can share some more of those tips so that we can get some more moms out there cooking. Okay? Everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Lauren Groveman, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with my guest today, Lauren Groveman, certified culinary professional, cookbook author, columnist, recipe developer, and much more. Lauren, you with me?
I'm here.
Great. So before the break, we were just talking about, you talked about cookies and how you could put some in the freezer so that you could pull it out when you want. And very often when I'm talking to people about cooking, I'm also talking about some time-saving tricks that they can do to make cooking easier for them during the week when they need to pull it out. Like I always talk to people, you know, when you make rice, you make twice as much so that you can have rice, you know, brown rice, which takes 45 minutes, already in the refrigerator that you can whip together, or you can even make half and put half in the freezer so you can pull it out at another time. Can you share some of the time-saving tricks that you've learned over the years with some of our listeners?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, you know, when I wrote my first cookbook, it was really from a very hopeful place. You know, it was really all the food that my kids grew up on. And then my second book was really, you know, my career had taken off and I, you know, was very busy, television, radio, a lot of stuff. And I didn't want to work at my children's expense. I didn't want them to not be able to maintain the level of deliciousness that I had provided before. They were used to that, and I certainly wasn't going to do anything to disrupt that. So I just had to come up with ways to do things, but quicker. And for example, I make homemade mixes. See, you know, this is really important for busy working people because you want to get the biggest bang for your buck in the nurturing department. You know, you want to be able to feel like it's quick to get that good family feeling. So things like I do is like I make homemade mixes for pancake mix. I make this in bulk in pancake mix that also makes cakes and cupcakes. I make spice blends. I make an assorted muffin mix that you just scoop from. And the reason why I do this is not just for the time element, but also because when I want to make something like pancakes or a muffin, and I hear the words, "These are the best pancakes I've ever had," from my children, I don't have to share that with a company in a box somewhere that was made in some factory somewhere. When I want, I own all of those good feelings myself. And that's, you know, that's really important. That little canister is a powerhouse in my kitchen for me. It talks to me and it talks to my kids. I'm telling you, I have gotten emails from all over the country about these pancakes in this pancake mix. It's a buttermilk pancake mix. Truly, and you double, you know, I mean, it also makes cupcakes and cakes. So, I mean, and it's easy. You just scoop. So on a day when you don't have the time to start from scratch, which is usually when most people, that's the thing that they get really, you know, bent out of shape about, because especially at holiday time with spice cookies, what I do is like a favorite ginger snap cookie, which has all these little spices in it and the leavening and all this stuff. I do that. I'll make five different batches of it on a month before the holidays so that I'll be able to put them in baggies, so it literally takes me 10 minutes to get the longest thing it takes is to soften the butter. That's the longest part of that, the whole thing, is softening the butter. So, and by the way, I have a tip on that, too. Just put it on a heating pad on low. Just, you know, truly. I mean, I keep a heating pad in my kitchen for when I'm making bread.
Really?
I do. I really do. It really helps me. Sometimes I have two heating pads going. On a cold day in my kitchen and I'm raising a bread dough, I have one on the bottom and I have one draped over the top on low, and it really helps them, you know, my dough to just really kind of cozy up. But but things like that, doing dry mixes, really help to not just get you something quickly on the table, but for a person who's busy and maybe conflicted about being busy, so busy with your children, it's a really a way for a busy person, not just mothers, by the way. You know, there's so much divorce, unfortunately. You know, men who have their children on alternate Wednesdays and on Saturdays, they need to know how to be nurturing, too. They need to know how to have a make a pot of chicken soup and to make a batch of cookies or whatever. And doing these mixes in advance where you just kind of follow after the mix is made, it's basically just scooping, leveling it off, and then adding your wet and dry ingredients together, and you have pancakes in the pan. It's really a very simple process. So, again, it comes back to using available time to take care of yourself for those times that feel a little frenetic and busy, so that you get to get takeaways, so you get more nurturing takeaway. You like you're killing, you know, all you're accomplishing all of these emotional checklists, these emotional checklists that we parents have, that we want to be everything to everybody. Well, doing little things like this helps you to do more in a lot of ways. Because if you're cooking for your family, like I said, you're enriching their lives in a sensory way. You're providing a place to share that meal where you're around the table where you actually learn about your children's day, and it's a safe place to communicate and congregate, and they learn from each other. It's a very Montessori type of atmosphere where the older ones share their experience with the younger ones. The children learn so many lessons at the table about how to,
it's so true. I love that you're touching on that, because I talk about that as well. I mean, it's not just about the food and feeding them physically. It's the conversations that happen around the table. That, you know, they learn about negotiation and being patient and waiting your turn.
And being appreciative and understanding that if you don't like something, that the person who's cooking there's a way to share that. There's a way to, you know, a lot of my cooking students would come to me and say things like, why should I cook? My husband's not home until 9 o'clock at night. You know, my kids are really picky. You know, these are issues, because it's very important that, you know, it's very difficult because cooking is an expression. It's a self-expression. It's an artistic expression. It's a nurturing expression. And of course, nobody wants to gravitate towards something that feels unappreciative, I'm alone, or whatever. But the first thing to remember is that when your children are there, you're not alone. And when you choose to not cook or just give them chicken McNuggets or a grilled cheese sandwich for dinner because your husband isn't home, you're giving your children a very clear message. Number one, that they're not worth the effort in their own right of a quality, nurturing, nourishing home-cooked meal. And also you're sending them the message that you're not worth it. And without a man around, without your spouse. And that's not beneficial, because I'm sure that you as a mother, if your children are living by themselves when they grow up and they get out of the house, you would say to yourself, boy, I hope my kid is eating. I hope my kid is feeling motivated to eat healthy things and take care of themselves. But they won't if they don't understand that they're worth it. And they don't understand that they're worth it not only as a child, but as an adult. And that they don't need another person around to make them feel worth it. You need to set the example for these children. So that's very, very important.
Yes, I agree with everything you're saying. It's so refreshing to hear someone else saying it, because it's just so true. I used to cook for the Waldorf School in Garden City. I took over their cafeteria and turned it into a healthy lunch program. But one of the main things that I felt was so important is that when kids walked into
the school building, you know, if they were smelling the dessert that I was making from, you know, that they were going to have in at lunchtime, they had this anticipation, and they were looking forward to coming into the cafeteria. And it was, you know, there's nothing worse than going into a cafeteria and smelling bleach and cleaning fluids,
oh,
you know.
God.
I mean, how many times do, you know, kids, it's very rare to walk into a school cafeteria and even very often restaurants and actually smell delicious smells.
I've walked into restaurants and I've said to them, I said, I pulled somebody over and I said, you know, you really need to saute something. Like you need to smell like there's life here, that this place is about a food establishment that's good, that you want to be here. You smell the cleaning fluid.
I think restaurants sometimes think that, I think they think that smelling bleach is going to make people think that the place is clean and that that's okay. But
trust
who wants
me,
to
I
smell that?
I want to smell onions cooking. You show me the way to sauteed onions are like, and by the way, that's really important for your listeners because those are types of ingredients, sauteed onions, sauteed garlic, simmering, vegetables and aromatics are things that help people to be glad to be home, and not just children, but also adults. We also need those things. We need that feeling of being nurtured. We just have to parent ourselves. Just because we leave our parents home, you know, doesn't mean we don't still need to be feel nurtured and loved. And we just need to be instrumental in that process. And a lot of people will ask me, well, how do you get a kid to eat if they're picky? Because this is a two-pronged process. Okay, so let's say a person has decided, my husband's not home. I'm gonna bite the bullet here and I'm gonna make family dinners important to my children. And I'm gonna start to incrementally introduce this. So let's say I have three kids and I had one child, my youngest, really did not like fish. She just didn't like it. So, but I wasn't going to not, and I've never, ever made two entrees in my life for my family. I make one entree, and what I do is, because fish is very, very healthy, and my children, my other children loved it, my husband loves it. I was never really a big fish eater as a kid. You know, my mother was always afraid that we'd choke on a fish bone, so like my whole limit of fish was like fillet of sole or something. It was like, so I really was very underexposed. So I would make fish for my family, and Jessie, instead, because I knew she didn't like fish, I did not want her to come to the table and say to herself, oh, tonight's the night, they don't care about me and what I eat. Like, I didn't want her to come to the table with her dukes up, you know, her fists up, feeling, I'm not going to like it here. So what I would always do is when there was fish on the table, I would always have either her favorite biscuit I would make or her favorite vegetable. Maybe it was sauteed corn or whatever it was. I would always, or have, you know, fresh applesauce on the table, something that made, that talked to her so that she might get to the table and look and say, oh, it's fish, and then look to its right and say, oh, there's my biscuits. Oh, there's my that. And so I would strategically weave fish into her life in a way where the overall feeling was pleasurable because she didn't view it as being neglected. So one day I was making my salmon, which was, with ginger and scallions and garlic and tamari and Dijon mustard. It was this wonderful marinade on salmon, and it was broiling. And all this one day, my daughter Jessie, she came into the kitchen. She was like eight, and she said, "What smells so good?" And I said, "Well, that's salmon." And she said, so she sat down. The girl ate almost 8 ounces of fish that night, and like that was her beginning. Now my kids, all of them, I roast whole fish, and I give it to them, and they pick it, and they leave a pile of bones on the plate. It's the most wonderful thing in the world. But that's how I incorporated, and I've always done this. So anybody out there who has picky children, strategically weave things in, expose them to vegetables, to fruits, to nuts, to grains in ways where it's not all or nothing. You need to be strategic. Let them come to the table and see things that are unfamiliar along with things that are familiar so that they're not hostile. They don't become hostile
You want this to be a loving, rich, wonderful experience.
Right. Right. I agree with you so much. You know, I talk to parents also who have picky eaters, and one thing I tell them when you're talking about really little kids, you know, I talk to little kids, and I love this, and so I'll share it again, is that, you know, I talk to kids how they're growing, and they're getting taller, and their shoe size is getting bigger as they get older. Well, all the parts of your body change, and so does your tongue. So what you didn't like when you were two, you might like when you're 2.5 or three or 3.5, that your tongue is also changing. And so you always have to try it, because one day you're going to like it and you're going to be so excited because it means you're getting older and, you know, and more mature. Well, I don't use the word mature for young kids, but you know what I mean? It's like talking to them about how their bodies are changing on so many levels, and their taste buds is just one more of those levels.
Absolutely.
And
I mean,
how many adults like food that they didn't like when they were little? And that's
totally. I mean, really, there are certain foods that I was a little girl, I could not understand the term cheesecake. It just totally grossed me out. Cheese and cake just totally flipped me out. But cheesecake is like one of my, that's like one of my weaknesses. It's like so funny how all of a sudden you become, I mean, talk about, especially gefilte fish. I mean, Bhavani, I mean, really,
right.
You know, gefilte fish is something that is the nightmare of children. And then all of a sudden you become an adult and say, you know, I want a piece of gefilte fish. It's like, yeah. How does that happen? It's just like the funniest. But I had a little boy in my house last night. He came over to see my hens. And it was the cutest thing. He's like, I don't know, he's 7 years old. He's adorable. And he came in and he looked at it was the cutest. He said to me, he said, oh, you have hens. Maybe you could make my family an omelet. And I said, well, an omelet for a family is called a frittata. Can you say frittata? He looked at me and said, frittata. These little kids are so cute. So, like, they're very, you know, not all little kids can't get it. Like, this little kid loves, he calls me the cooker. He loves food. He loves vegetables. He loves frittatas. He loves bread.
Right.
You know, so it's like, so, like, don't underestimate children. Don't underestimate them and think that they're just not capable of liking something. You have to just keep exposing them. And, again, that aroma is, like, the very... And by the way, for people who are, you know, like a great way to, you know, sometimes people can't do this for dinner religiously. There's nothing wrong with having, you know, a breakfast that's savory.
A frittata for dinner.
A frittata, for example.
Right.
I mean, or you could have, you know, like, you know, sautéed, you know, vegetables in eggs and, you know, like eggs, lox, and onions. And it's just like there's so many things, quiche, all sorts of things that you can do in the morning hours or brunch on a Sunday. So
you know what? Like, and that goes in the reverse. For the breakfast, you don't have to have eggs or bagels. You can have something more savory. You can have last night's leftover
stir
fry for breakfast. And you, if you want, you can throw an egg in with last night's stir fry and make it like a fried rice type of thing, you know?
Exactly. And use what you did yesterday. If you have grilled vegetables, don't throw them out when you have leftover. You use them the next day in something else. You reinvent them. You don't need to start from the beginning all the time. It's like your life is a canvas, and you have like, you leave shades, different colors. Every day you start with something maybe from yesterday. The thing I really want to stress to your listeners, and this is something that surely you've covered from time to time, is that people often who view cooking, especially today, people who are very career-oriented, very production-oriented, they think cooking and having a homemade existence, a hands-on existence to the foods that we put into our bodies, that we don't give all the responsibility to takeout places, to companies, to people over there, but we take more control over here. They think that somehow that's telling people to take a step backwards. And the truth is, it is not at all. It's actually very, very progressive. It's helping people to actually incorporate the best parts of what used to be into a very progressive
technologically laden world for all the right reasons.
Well, especially in today's world where we don't know the quality of the food that we're getting when we go out to eat. You know, that's what I say. With the amount that people eat out and not knowing the quality of the ingredients, it, you know, you have to start taking, you know, taking that into your own hands and empowering yourself to provide the food for you and your family. But I'm looking at the clock and I'm realizing we are out of time. And before we sign off, I would like you to share with everybody your website and how they can get in touch with you if they have more questions.
Oh, thanks, Bhavani. My website is laurengrobman.com. Just, you know, go to myname.com. And you could also follow me on Instagram or, you know, Facebook. I post pictures all the time. Me and my hens are a new story. We're having a really grand old time here. And I appreciate
that's like me
time.
And my bees. I got bees.
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. But it's been a pleasure talking to you. And if you're ever in my neck of the woods in Western Connecticut, come on over.
Thank you, Lauren, and thank you, everybody, for listening. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. I wish you all a wonderful rest of the week, and I'll see you again next week. Bye for now.